Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally known expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist, and he's the director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can email your questions directly to the doctors. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu. You can also call 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller will be talking about lymphoma. They're joined by Dr. Francine Foss, a professor of medical oncology and the co-director of the Yale Cancer Center Leukemia, Lymphoma, and Myeloma Program.
Francine, I want to start out with a very basic question. I think when people hear the word cancer, they tend to think of lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer. How are those different from lymphoma? What makes lymphoma different and special?
Well, lymphoma is a disease of the white blood cells or the lymph nodes. And so oftentimes, unlike colon cancer or breast cancer or lung cancer, oftentimes a patient doesn't actually know that they have lymphoma because some of these lymph nodes are internal. And in some cases, patients can actually have lymphoma for a long time, and it's oftentimes diagnosed only when they go to the doctor for another reason.
And what are the different types of lymphoma?
Well, there are two major categories of lymphoma. There are the Hodgkin's lymphomas and the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. The Hodgkin's lymphomas comprise about 5,000 cases per year in the United States. The non-Hodgkin's lymphomas by far are the more prevalent types of lymphoma. In that non-Hodgkin's group, you have both B-cell and T-cell, and within each one of those categories, you have a whole bunch of other subcategories of disease.
So it's actually very, very complicated, and I guess, unfortunately for the listeners out there, when they hear lymphomas, they kind of lump everything all together. But really, they are very different entities, and treatment approaches are also can be quite different depending upon the specific lymphoma.
That's right. The treatment really depends on the specific subtype of lymphoma, but also it depends on how far the lymphoma has spread and what parts of the body are involved. There are other features of the lymphoma as well that we take into consideration. So oftentimes, a treatment that's recommended for one patient may not be relevant to another patient.
Right.
Now, well, you know, sometimes patients, again, people have heard it in the public, my friend had a cancer and it went to the lymph nodes, and they think that's a very bad thing. Does that same kind of rule apply to lymphoma? In terms of prognosis, does involvement of lymph nodes mean that it's a particularly bad disease?
No, and I think there is a lot of confusion on that point by the part of a lot of people because, as you know, many lymphomas occur in lymph nodes, but they can also occur in other parts of the body too. So somebody with lymphoma, in fact, may have a lesion in the breast or the lung. And I think there is a lot of confusion because when you think about the solid tumors like lung cancer where people don't do so well, you have to be very careful to separate that from lymphoma. Lymphoma really is a curable disease in almost half of the patients who have it.
So I think that really is an important point to emphasize for listeners out there that lymphomas, as you say, really are treatable and potentially curable. Even if they're widespread throughout the body, in sharp contrast to, say, solid tumors, which are treatable but may not be as curable as the lymphomas.
That's right. I think it's important for patients to keep that in mind. And even if your doctor tells you that you have advanced stage lymphoma, oftentimes you will respond very nicely to chemotherapy and possibly radiation therapy as well. And many of our patients actually become long-term survivors.
Francine, what causes lymphoma? Any idea?
Well, it's unclear, but there are a couple of studies which suggest that lymphoma may be associated with various occupational exposures to chemicals. There are lots of pesticides and chemicals in our environment. And in fact, if you look at the overall incidence of lymphomas, they're increasing over the last 10 or 15 years. That may be associated with pollution, increased radiation due to loss of the ozone layer, and other factors that we haven't identified. There are some lymphomas that are associated with viruses, but those are very rare. And there are also some lymphomas that run in families.
All right, so actually along those lines, we'll pose you a couple of questions, truth or myth, that if a parent has lymphoma, that their son or daughter is at very high risk. Is that truth, myth?
That's myth for most patients. The chance of you having a familial lymphoma is very, very low.
All right. Truth or myth, if someone's exposed to the monovirus, the Epstein-Barr virus, they're at very high risk of developing lymphoma.
Again, that's another myth. The monovirus can be associated with lymphoma, but the number of cases is very small.
And how about the HIV virus?
Well, the HIV virus predisposes patients to a lot of different diseases, and because it suppresses the immune system, it may allow those patients to have a higher incidence of developing lymphomas, among other diseases.
And also, right there, there also is an increased risk of developing lymphomas in patients who've undergone transplantation of, say, the liver, kidneys, or other organs.
That's right, and that's partially due to the fact that we've developed such good drugs to suppress the immune system to allow those organs not to be rejected, that we're also suppressing the part of the immune system that surveys and gets rid of malignant cells. And so in that case, there is an increased incidence of different types of lymphomas.
You know, let me ask just your opinion on something. You know, some people say that, you know, all of us probably have cancer at one time or another, and our immune system fights it off. What's your view in regards to lymphoma?
Well, I think that's a very important point and something that we're just starting to recognize now, and that is the value of our immune system in terms of surveying and going out and scavenging cells that may have undergone various types of mutations. These are occurring all the time in our body in multiple places and related to multiple different events and things that we're exposed to. And what happens is that our immune cells, specifically the T cells, are killing these cells that they recognize as foreign that have undergone mutations. In any situation where the immune system is suppressed, be it from medications, if you've had a kidney transplant, or if you have HIV, the immune system just isn't working as well to go out there and scavenge. And in that situation, you have a higher incidence of having one of these malignant cells be able to grow large enough to develop a tumor or a cancer.
Francine, what are the symptoms that we typically think about that may be associated with lymphoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Well, one of the tricky things about lymphoma is that many patients actually have no symptoms. They may be diagnosed based on going to the doctor for another reason and having the doctor find a lymph node on physical exam or perhaps find something abnormal in their blood work. Other symptoms could be swelling of lymph nodes, being fatigued, weak, or developing night sweats or other symptoms. But generally speaking, a lot of our patients really don't have many symptoms when they come in.
So if a patient notices an enlarged lymph node, what are some of the possibilities? It sounds like lymphoma is one of them, but what do you think about?
Well, it really depends on the patient and the situation. Many of us have lymph nodes. If you examine your neck, you can probably feel a couple of little bumps. And this is really just your normal immune system working. Lymph nodes will get large if you're exposed to bacteria or viruses, as we all are all the time. The thing that really tips us off that there's a problem is if there's a lymph node that's enlarging over time, and that's enlarging at a rate that we think is rapid and perhaps not related to an infection. In some cases, these lymph nodes can pop up very quickly. And so oftentimes what a doctor would do would be to examine you, feel the lymph node, and then if it's not really significantly enlarged, they may watch it for a couple of weeks and see what happens. At some point when the doctor is then convinced that this isn't just a simple infection, they may recommend that you have a lymph node biopsy.
And maybe truth or myth here also. So if one has a lymph node and it's tender to touch, is that more likely to be cancer as opposed to some benign cause?
In fact, that's more likely to be not cancer. Most of the tender lymph nodes are tender because you have an infection or an inflammation.
Yeah, so I remember just my own practice of oncology in the community, but seeing people that had a big node where we really suspect lymphoma and then finding out, thankfully, they did not, which is very gratifying.
That's right, and oftentimes an oncologist doesn't have that experience of seeing a patient that doesn't have cancer.
Right.
But I think it's important for patients with enlarged lymph nodes, if they do have a biopsy, to keep an open mind until they get their final path report.
What tests does a patient typically have? There's so many different kinds of tests available, PET scans, MRIs. What do you see as sort of the most valuable kind of staging test? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's actually changing now, too. It used to be that we got CAT scans on everybody, and CAT scans showed whether lymph nodes were enlarged or not, but it didn't necessarily tell us whether those lymph nodes were involved with lymphoma. Now we have a new imaging technique called PET scan, which involves a radio-labeled element that actually enhances in lymph nodes that are involved with lymphoma. So we can take a picture and see all of the lymph nodes and only see the ones that are involved with lymphoma light up on the PET scan. We oftentimes do a CAT scan with the PET scan and put all that information together to come up with a staging for the patient. Now, I will say that the PET scan takes a little bit more time for the patient, and you do have to be fasting, so it's a little bit different than just getting a CAT scan. But that's the direction that we're going in lymphoma, to stage patients initially and then after they've had treatment.
And are there any other diagnostic tests that need to be done as part of the evaluation process in addition to the PET scan or the CT scan?
Well, in addition to getting the PET scan, we get routine blood work, and we also, in many instances, will get a bone marrow biopsy. And that involves numbing up an area on the back and putting a very small needle in to aspirate some of the bone marrow. The reason we do that is to see whether the lymphoma has spread to the bone marrow. It's not uncommon with certain types of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in particular to have bone marrow involvement.
Francine, there's typically, again, people think of cancer and they think of a disease that really changes rapidly. But on the other hand, in lymphoma, there's a whole interest in indolent lymphomas. What does that mean and to you as a clinician?
Well, about a third of the lymphomas we see fall into this indolent lymphoma category. And what this really means is that the lymphoma is very slow growing. In fact, we did a study about 20 years ago at the National Cancer Institute where we looked at the behavior of these indolent lymphomas, and we found that you could actually watch and wait and not even treat these patients, and that the lymphoma would just be very slow growing over time. It really didn't make any difference whether you gave chemotherapy. And so I think it's important when you have a diagnosis of lymphoma to talk to your doctor about what type of lymphoma you have. And if you do have indolent lymphoma, you need to ask a lot of questions because there are new treatments out there now for indolent lymphoma. It used to be that we only had chemotherapy, and in that case, we knew that giving chemotherapy versus watch and wait really didn't make any difference. But now that we have new drugs like rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody and really has very little toxicity in terms of side effects, we're starting to rethink our strategy for approaching patients with low-grade lymphoma, and perhaps we could use this monoclonal antibody and give it on an intermittent basis, and perhaps that would keep their lymphoma under control for a longer period of time.
Are there any other situations in which you might be more inclined to, say, treat with Rituxan and or other treatments, you know, in patients who have this low-grade indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Well, the reason that we treat low-grade lymphoma is based on whether or not the patient actually has a symptom. So, for instance, if the lymph nodes are enlarged and they might be pushing on an organ, for instance, or if there's extensive involvement in the bone marrow and the bone marrow isn't making normal cells, or if the patient has symptoms like fatigue or weakness related to their lymphoma, then that would be an indication to treat those patients.
Those kind of therapies with what you call monoclonal antibodies, do they have a lot of side effects? Is it similar to chemotherapy?
Well, an antibody is basically a protein substance that your body makes, and a monoclonal antibody is directed against a specific protein on the surface of the tumor cell. So these antibodies are injected, and they go directly to the tumor site, and they affect the tumor cell so that they eventually inhibit the tumor cell from growing. Now, because these are proteins, there might be an initial reaction when you get the infusion. However, we can manage that with steroids and other medications. And generally speaking, after you get one or two infusions, the antibody infusions are tolerated very well. Patients really don't even know they're getting a treatment. There are no symptoms like nausea, vomiting, hair loss, or anything else that you attribute to chemotherapy.
Again, the beauty of this kind of treatment, it really is like a targeted therapy in that it's targeting a specific process that's on the lymphoma cell.
That's right. This is what we call a biological therapy, which means that we're directly trying to attack the tumor cell with a very specific agent, as opposed to chemotherapy. So chemotherapy is basically a chemical that goes into your body and affects not only the tumor cells, but also normal healthy cells as well.
Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to us to Dr. Foss at canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information from Dr. Francine Foss from the Yale Cancer Center.
You know, it's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. But major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from prostate cancer. Screening for this disease can be performed quickly and easily in the physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, prostate cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute. More information available at yalecancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Dr. Francine Foss, discussing the latest treatment options for patients with lymphoma. Francine, we were just talking about patients with a, what we call low, you were discussing as a low-grade lymphoma. Can you think of an example of someone you've treated, sort of a typical patient?
Yes, I'd like to talk about a lady that I'm treating right now who's a very active woman. She works both in New York as well as here in Connecticut, travels extensively, and came in with enlarged lymph nodes without symptoms with a diagnosis of low-grade lymphoma. When we looked at her PET scan, we saw that she had multiple areas of involvement, and in fact, some of these nodes were a little bit bigger than I felt, you know, I was comfortable with in terms of looking at, you know, watching and waiting versus treating her. And so we had extensive discussions about treatment and decided that she would receive rituximab. So she got 4 doses of the monoclonal antibody. Now, that was 18 months ago. Since then, we've done serial PET scans every 3 or 4 months. She's had really no change in her disease. She's very functional, working full-time, and really, I think, is an example of what can happen with patients with low-grade lymphoma. She's going about her normal life, and she knows that at some point, if her PET scan shows that these nodes are enlarging again, that she'll be eligible to receive another 4 doses of the rituximab. And again, that may give her a remission that lasts, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years.
Francine, is there any situation, say, for instance, for this patient, where you would consider chemotherapy?
Well, this patient is cognizant of the potential complications of chemotherapy and would like to delay it as long as possible. And really, there's no reason to give chemotherapy unless the monoclonal antibody treatment doesn't work. But I'd like to say at this point that there are a number of options to chemotherapy. There's also a radio-labeled monoclonal antibody that directly takes radioactivity to the site of the tumor, and this may be an option for patients. The advantage of this is that it's a one-shot deal. You come in, you get your dose of radio-labeled antibody, and that stays in your system for a long time. So I think if we got to the point where we were talking about chemotherapy, I certainly would discuss monoclonal antibodies, other monoclonal antibodies, radio-labeled antibodies, and potentially other biological therapies as well.
Now, there's other types of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that you brought up earlier. Can you tell us about the other types where you would consider chemotherapy and early on?
Well, there are patients with what we call diffuse large cell lymphoma, which is a B-cell lymphoma that is growing rapidly. In that case, we would institute chemotherapy right away. And interestingly, we also use the monoclonal antibody rituximab with chemotherapy because we know from multiple studies that have been done that that makes the chemotherapy work better. Now, in the case of these large cell lymphoma patients, about half of those patients will actually be cured with 6 cycles of chemotherapy. We also know that if patients relapse after their chemotherapy, we have a very high chance of curing them with more chemotherapy and an autologous bone marrow transplant, which means that we take cells from the patient and we put those cells in the freezer. We then give them high doses of chemotherapy and we give them back their own cells.
Now, what's the theory underlying that? I mean, why does bone marrow transplant work?
Well, in this case, bone marrow transplant is a way of allowing us to give very high doses of chemotherapy that might eradicate a patient's own bone marrow function. So what we do is we stimulate the bone marrow in advance, and we make the bone marrow produce lots of stem cells. We then take those stem cells out of the blood and then give the patient the very high doses of chemotherapy. And then when their blood counts go down, we give them back their stem cells to rescue their bone marrow.
And again, I think the reason why we can give high doses of chemotherapy and then follow up by transplant is that we know that the lymphoma cells, those tumors specifically, are very sensitive to chemotherapy.
That's right. And in fact, if a patient doesn't respond to, say, the conventional doses of chemotherapy, that doesn't mean that they're not going to respond when they get these high-dose regimens.
I know a common question that's asked of me sometimes is in patients who have metastatic colon cancer or another GI cancer, who've kind of gone through all of the usual treatments, and then they say, Dr. Chu, you know, am I eligible for a transplant, right? Because we hear that transplants so successful for cancer in general. But I think, you know, again, for the listeners out there, don't be confused. You know, the transplant setting is really only applicable for those tumors that are really sensitive to chemotherapy. And unfortunately, a solid tumor like colon cancer doesn't fall in that category.
Francine, the other kind of transplant where it comes from a donor is allogeneic transplant. How is that different, and what are the forces that are working there to help the patient?
Well, an allogeneic transplant involves getting cells from somebody else. And so by definition, that means that new cells are going to come into your body. Those cells may potentially reject your body. So what happens with a donor is that the donor cells may recognize proteins on the surface of the patient's cells and institute a process called graft versus host disease. What that means is that there may be a skin rash, elevation of liver function tests, as well as the development of diarrhea. So this is the major complication when we do this kind of a transplant. Of course, those new donor cells are also going to recognize the patient's tumor cells as being foreign, and that's really the goal of that kind of a transplant. The goal is to give the patient a new immune system, T cells from a donor that will recognize their lymphoma cells wherever they're hiding out in the body and will kill those cells. And so really that's what we call immunotherapy.
Francine, in addition to obviously being an expert in lymphomas, you also are one of the world's leading experts in a particular type of lymphoma called cutaneous T cell lymphoma. Maybe you can just tell our listeners out there what that lymphoma is, and then we can get into maybe some of the treatment strategies that you've really played a seminal role in.
This is a very disfiguring disease that predominantly presents in the skin. So patients will develop skin rashes or tumors. In some cases, they can develop ulcerations on the skin. But this disease doesn't just involve the skin. Oftentimes, it's in the blood and the lymph nodes as well. And this can be a very, very, very difficult disease to treat, because first of all, the cells aren't as sensitive to chemotherapy as the cells, say, in B-cell lymphoma, but also because there are lots of symptoms for the patient. Many patients have involvement of their face or areas of their skin that are visible to other people. Patients can develop frequent infections. They can have bad itching and other complications from this disease.
Now, you've done some fascinating work on interleukin-2 fused with a toxin. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, what we've done is we've taken the interleukin-2 gene and we've hooked it up to diphtheria toxin to create what we call a recombinant fusion protein. What this molecule does is that it actually seeks out cells that have the interleukin-2 receptor. It binds to those cells, and it introduces the toxin specifically into those cells. So this is another kind of what we call targeted therapy, just like the rituximab monoclonal antibody specifically binds only to a certain receptor on the cell. The fusion protein recognizes only the cells that have that receptor and only introduces the toxin into those cells. So this is, again, another very selective way to kill these kinds of T-cell lymphomas.
And you've also been involved in two of the other new therapies that have been recently approved for the treatment of CTCL.
Right. Another interesting therapy that was approved, in fact, this year is vorinostat, which is what we call an HDAC inhibitor. This drug was approved for patients with advanced CTCL, but the important thing about it for all cancer patients is that this drug has activity in a number of different types of tumors. We're just now starting to understand how this type of therapy works. And in fact, there are a whole bunch of HDAC inhibitors that are now in clinical trials.
For me too, what are HDAC? What is HDAC?
HDAC stands for histone deacetylase inhibitor. And basically, these are drugs that attack your DNA and modify your DNA so that they induce various genes that help tumor cells to die. So this is a whole new strategy to treat cancer.
Francine, can you tell us some of the clinical trials that you and your research team here at the Yale Cancer Center are actively involved in?
Well, there are a number of clinical trials ongoing now for patients with lymphoma, including investigation of some of these new drugs, such as these new HDAC inhibitors, as well as some novel monoclonal antibodies. In addition, we have some trials where we're combining some of these new biological therapies with conventional chemotherapy as a first-line treatment for patients with lymphoma. We also have some trials for patients undergoing bone marrow transplant. Specifically, we have a novel conditioning regimen to prepare patients for the transplant that involves the use of extracorporeal photopheresis, which is a light-based therapy that modulates the immune system of the patient so that they don't develop rejection of the graft or graft-versus-host disease.
And this last study really is quite important because, as you had said earlier, one of the big problems with transplantation is the increased risk of developing graft-versus-host disease. And what you found previously is that with this new treatment, you really could dramatically reduce that side effect but still maintain the good effects against the lymphoma.
That's right. Prior to our doing this study, the only way to really deal with graft-versus-host disease was to give drugs to the patient ahead of time as well as after the transplant. So this approach involves, as I mentioned, ultraviolet light treatment to the white blood cells of the patient. It doesn't involve a drug, and it really is a novel approach to try to so-called condition the patient before the donor T cells or the stem cells are put into the patient. And in fact, using this approach, we've shown that we've reduced the incidence of acute graft versus host disease significantly in over 120 patients who received this kind of a transplant regimen.
Francine, in terms of the team of patients, the team of faculty and staff and experts who are involved in seeing patients, who is on that team when a patient comes to Yale or to another medical center?
Well, I think it's important for patients to know that there's more than just your doctor on your team. Many teams will have a nurse practitioner, as well as some of the clinic nurses that get to know the patient if they come in frequently. We have social workers that work as part of our team. We have a nutritionist that comes by and visits every patient when they're waiting to see their physician. We also have support groups, and I think patients need to be aware of those. There are specific support groups for specific types of cancer, as well as overall support groups for patients. There are also we also try to provide information for patients about foundations and societies that may have additional information, such as in the case of lymphoma, there's the Lymphoma Research Foundation and there's the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. Both of these organizations do have Connecticut chapters and are very active with our patients.
Francine, as we near the end of the program this evening, I just wanted to get your thoughts as to how the landscape for the treatment of lymphoma has really changed and evolved over, say, the past 20 years since we were fellows back at the NCI in Bethesda.
Well, I think about 20 years ago or so, we thought that the only approach to treating lymphoma was to give chemotherapy drugs, essentially the same kind of chemotherapy we gave for other tumor types. Now that we've understood the biology of lymphomas a little bit better due to basic research, we've been able to identify specific proteins and receptors so that we can develop targeted therapy. We've also been able to understand the mechanism by which these cells grow, so we've now been able to develop drugs that are much more specific. In addition, we've been able to develop drugs that have very little toxicity for the patient. And I think the major goal now is to try to get patients in remission and then to maintain them. And so we also have learned that after giving chemotherapy, if we don't do anything, patients may relapse. So we've developed a whole different strategy for patients now that may involve not only your initial therapy, but also some ongoing treatment, perhaps in some cases for the rest of your life.
Where do you think things are headed, if you were to make some predictions in terms of the next 5 years?
Well, one of the interesting things with some of these new drugs is that it may in fact be that we are changing the natural history of lymphoma. It may in fact be that while we used to say that we really couldn't cure patients with low-grade lymphoma, they may in fact be cured with some of these novel treatment approaches. It's just going to take us another 5 or 10 years to follow these patients to know for sure whether these treatments really are curing them. But I think the future is very bright for lymphoma because there are a lot of new drugs, a lot of new treatment strategies, and I think the overall survival for most patients is getting better if we look over the last 10 years.
And Francine, thanks. It's been great having you. It's been very informative, and we look forward to having you on a future program to give us an update as to where things are. Until then and until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu.
And Dr. Ken Miller.
From the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we pay tribute to Breast Cancer Awareness Month.